everybody. Welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim, your host, and I'm here, as usual, with Andy Steiger and Chris Battle.
Greetings, everybody.
Morning.
All right, so...
Afternoon, whenever you're listening.
That's right, or evening.
Good evening.
Yeah, whatever puts you to sleep at night.
So we have Steve Kim on the podcast.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah.
Listen to my voice.
Can I speak
back in that
in
bus
the
up.
Same
Steve, I'm just going to lay down on the floor here and let you run over me.
Speaking of boring arguments.
So we have some news for you. Today is the first day of the Thinking Series course.
Woohoo!
Mm-hmm. Woo! The online course.
Yeah, we're pretty stoked about that.
Yeah.
Today,
so
the course, is it open currently?
It's currently available. The online course officially starts tomorrow.
Right.
The calendar starts tomorrow, but we made it available a day in advance so everybody who's taking it can prepare themselves, you know, getting the blog up and running. The Deagle set up.
Exactly. There's a few details we wanted people to know about ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, we got something coming up tomorrow night.
6 p.m. Pacific Standard mm-hmm. Time. Mm-hmm. I was about to say Eastern. Pacific Standard Time, 6 p.m. We have a webinar. And if you look on your Thinking Series, and this is for Thinking Series students, obviously, but if you mm-hmm. look on your in your syllabus, you'll be able to see the links to where to get into that. And then we're going to be sitting around and answering questions and giving a, I want to say production, but displaying some of the intricacies of the course that are going to be shown live in Andy's course at Columbia. But then so we'll be able mm-hmm. to give the online students an idea of what to do when it comes to things like blogging, Deagle, and all of these things. If you don't understand what those are, fear not, you will understand fully. Mm-hmm. Even as you are fully known.
That's
nice.
Right.
So by the way, I think it's pretty cool. Just the numbers of people that we've got. We got three mm-hmm. people doing it for credit, 5 doing it for certificate.
Mm-hmm.
Now we had a lot more interest, but we had to cut it off.
Cause yeah.
it's a lot of grading. Mm-hmm. That includes, I've got 37 people in class.
Right.
But then how many open students do we have?
People who have created their username and password, there's well over 80.
That's great.
And tell me, guys, is that still open for people too? If they want to take it just as an open student, are they able to do that?
They're still welcome to come and do that, but we're going to have to cap it at 200.
Yeah.
And so until that happens, it's open. You can go onto the website and... but you do have to create a username and password, and you might want to do that before it fills up.
Yeah. And so that's where you get all the benefits of the Thinking Series course online without paying and then without the stress of assignments and whatnot. So it's not as challenging, but yet you still get the top quality education.
Right. And if you would like to take it for certificate and you just didn't have a chance to get around to it this time around, we will be coming back in January and offer the course again. So be sure to keep your ears open and eyes open for any announcements from us.
And we'd love to see you tomorrow night in our live webinar.
Right. If you'd like to be there. Yeah. If you'd like to join us, you're welcome to do that. I'll post that information up on the website for this podcast episode. So keep your eyes open for that.
Awesome.
So let's move on then.
Yeah. Actually, our friend Terry passed this along to us, and she's found an article, and it's interesting because for those of you who have been following, it's been going on in the news for some time, and I think in the sort of the public square in the medical field about assisted suicide, or people are calling it euthanasia, or some are calling it medical aid in dying, I think is the new nice way of putting it. Mm-hmm. But essentially it's euthanasia. And that's when people have a terminal disease or something like that, and they want to expire on their own terms. So this has been passed in Quebec, as we all know, amidst some controversy. And now the people in the legal profession are running into an issue. They've figured out that what they actually write on the death certificate has implications,
mm-hmm.
weirdly enough, right? Sarcasm
intended.
Thank you. I was going to say implied, but anyway. So on the death certificates, they've realized that if they put euthanasia, and it's essentially suicide, that impacts insurance policies.
Right.
So now they're having to rethink, and I'm kind of smiling, but it just, cause it's insane to me that this is even an issue. Right. But it's, it's an obvious one, but they come across, but,
so what are they going to say?
What are
these death certificates? So they're like, their insurance is still valid. You know,
what's interesting to me though, is that the Quebec legislation, they made room for that too, right? They put in that provision saying that even if it's a suicide, if it's by medical assistance, then insurance companies still have to pay out, right? So they have that in there, and yet somehow the Quebec College of Doctors, they feel a little uncomfortable with that.
Yeah.
I don't really get that, why that might be.
Potentially because it's wrong. Throwing it out. You know what I mean? But yeah, but
sarcasm intended.
Again, right? But yeah, it's funny. So now what they've decided to do, or what, sorry, I shouldn't say they've decided to do, what they're toying with the idea of doing is writing down the cause of death being the terminal disease or the whatever illness they have.
Underlying pathology, as they called it.
Exactly. And doing that as the cause of death, when in reality, that's not true. That doesn't line up with reality. So I think just the ethical implications of all this are unfolding before our eyes, and we're seeing where they're having to basically blatantly lie, or they're just they're tinkering with the idea of blatantly lying regarding this in order to make it more palpable, right?
It's interesting.
Palpable.
It's interesting, isn't it, that you know, when euthanasia was first being talked about, you know, the implications of it were kind of swept under the rug. And it's always how it works, right? And now once you start getting down that road, the implications of these ideas are starting to, you know, unfold before us. And they're you know, trying to work around this. And this gets back to, I think, what our original concerns were, more than, you know, not just that taking human life is wrong, but that this is a slippery slope and leads to all kinds of issues, and, you know, this being one of them. What are we going to say on their death certificate? Exactly how did they die? And is this suicide? You know, because it's interesting, even in our culture today, suicide is frowned upon. It's not seen as a good thing, although they're trying to make this more of like an honorable death in the sense of, you know, that it's kind of like, it's kind of like sticking it to cancer, right? Or whatever it is that's got you. You know, I'm going down on my own terms.
So I find that really fascinating, because the whole euthanasia movement, their sort of go-to was that it gives dignity to the person that's dying.
Right.
Right. And yet on the flip side, now they're trying to kind of do something of a cover up, if you will. Right.
It's showing that there's not dignity.
If it's so dignifying, then why such discomfort? Why the need for cover-ups?
Yeah, why not be proud of this action, right? Because, like you said, it is, in a sense, sticking it to whatever, and it's me going out on my own terms, but yet I'm not owning up to what I'm doing, in a sense, right?
That kind of sounds like existentialism.
Oh, absolutely. That's existentialism. I'll exist on my own terms, and when I'm ready not to exist, I'll extinguish myself. Thank you very much.
These are some of the consequences of the ideas that we hold. Really.
Yeah. You know what? One of the questions that we had received not too long ago was somebody had asked, why was it? And this unfolds into some other areas, particularly with Catholicism and, you know, their view of euthanasia, because they frown upon, which others do as well, but particularly with the Catholics, on suicide.
Right.
And one of the questions that we had received that we talked about not too long ago was, why was it that the Catholics view suicide as an unforgivable sin?
Well, I grew up Roman Catholic, and this was something that we always kind of, not always, but we talked about mortal sins a fair bit. The distinction between mortal sins and venial sins, they were pretty important to us. And the reason being, well, mortal sins were so grave that it actually cancels the effect of saving grace, that sort of a thing, right? And so things like murder, adultery, sexual immorality of any kind. These are all very serious mortal sins. It's really mortal.
Your soul is in jeopardy.
That's right. And so what happens when you commit suicide is that you are killing yourself. So that's mortal sin. And you die in that state of mortal sin.
We should clarify that one of the Ten Commandments is not to kill.
Yeah, do not kill.
And
yeah.
Suicide is taking a life. You're taking your own life. And so in that way, it's a mortal sin.
So in this whole debate over euthanasia then or assisted suicide, there is this underlying assumption is that we own our lives and we can do with it what we will. But that's not at all true from a Christian perspective. God owns everything. God is the ruler of it. He gave it to us as a gift, right? And he owns it. And we just have stewardship over it. And yet it's Genesis 3 all over again. We're kind of setting out to be the masters of our own life, our own destiny.
Which is interesting as I talk to different people on the subject, because there's a few things in our lives that we just have no control over. Mm-hmm. One of them is when and where we're born and that we're born at all.
Right.
And then this other one is death, but that we are starting to challenge and change. We're starting to change too, the birth one too, although we can't control it for ourselves, but mm-hmm. You know, with abortion, we determine whether or not a life is worth keeping or not. Mm-hmm. And now in death, we're determining whether or not a life is worth continuing or not. And in many ways, it is a matter of control, of whether or not I'll let God be in control or I'll take control for myself. It's one of the reasons why when I talk about sin, ultimately it comes down to rebellion. Mm. It's this idea of really putting ourselves in the place of God and that we determine the time and place. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting challenges that we're continuing to face in our culture in the 21st century as we rebel against God in new ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think this is especially poignant because I know I've heard you say it, Andy, and yourself as well, Steve, but ideas have consequences. Mm-hmm. And here is a perfect example of that sort of meeting itself out in reality, right? Like what starts off as, you know, a seemingly harmless, again, sarcastic, but for as far as the public sphere goes, like, hey, you know, hey, why not? You know, if they want to go out with some dignity, why not? Kind of thing.
And mm-hmm. often but, they'll use cases that, you know, are not as easy to dismiss, you mm-hmm. know, like somebody who's in grievous pain, for example.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you'll often get these extreme examples. However, it was interesting on the news that girl from Portland who took her own life.
Brittany Maynard, I think was yeah. her name. Yeah.
Maynard.
Yeah.
Yeah. When she took her life, I mean, she was far from being in any pain. She decided she didn't even want to get to that point that she would just take. When she got the diagnosis that, yeah. you know, it was terminal, she just decided, well, then I'll mm-hmm. take my life when I'm ready. By the way, this is just a side note. There's an interesting case that came recently of a doctor who was diagnosing people with cancer who, in fact, didn't have cancer. Mm. And then he was treating them for cancer. It's truly heinous what this guy did. He's now in prison.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, are you like, first of all, I mean, there's just that. I mean, sure, that's very rare that you might not actually even have cancer. But beyond that, like, I mean, you don't know the future and you don't know what's going to take place. And as well as being willing to walk whatever road God brings you mm-hmm. and that you find yourself in. Mm-hmm. I think our challenges that we're going to need to continue to face is talk on these issues.
Well, I think if you talk about dignity, to me, that's the ultimate dignity is toughing it out till the end, right? With, you know, I don't want to mean like a stiff upper lip, but I mean, I think there's dignity, there's pride, there's excellence in finishing the race.
There's also relationship.
Yeah.
I don't like euthanasia to me is like at the heart of narcissism.
Yeah. Selfishness.
Right? Selfishness. It's all about me and what I want and when I'm ready to go. So again, these are things that we're going to need to consider. And as this story unfolds, there's more things I'm sure that are going to come up that our culture is going to be facing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. On that note, let's move on to the arguments for the existence of God. So far, we've covered the cosmological arguments, the various forms of it. We talked, Chris, you and me, we talked a little bit about the moral argument. Today, we wanted to kind of wrap it up with another one. This one is really, really abstract for lots of people. So,
mm-hmm.
So we're going to endeavor to bring it down to earth as much as we can.
This was notoriously the most difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading Job 38 this morning when God says, "All right, Job, gird up your loins and see if you can handle these next words of mine." So my encouragement is for all of us.
Gird your loins.
Gird your loins.
But you know what? Before we get into this, by the way, we're talking about the ontological argument
right
today. Before we get into that, though, I thought it might be good just to remind our listeners that when we talk about God's existence, we arguments for God's existence, this isn't one of those silver bullet ideas.
No, far from it.
Yeah, right. But if you just can understand the ontological argument, you'll have to believe that God exists.
Yeah.
I mean, it just doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
As much as I wished that it did,
mm-hmm.
I wish that it did. Maybe I'm glad actually that it's the way it is.
There's rare examples though. Like John Mark Reynolds tells a story about a philosopher who, like, he read through Plantinga's version, the modal argument of the modal aspect or version of the ontological argument, and was convinced and said, "I guess I got to become a Christian because of that."
Yeah, you'll hear those cases, but then you also, people that I talk to quite regularly, that it doesn't matter what argument you give them, nothing's going to convince them.
Yeah. It's a matter of the heart, right?
Exactly.
You suppress the truth because you don't want it to be true.
Mm-hmm.
Some atheists are honest enough to actually admit that, like Thomas Nagel, who said, "I don't want there to be a God."
Yeah. Bertrand Russell said the same thing because he wanted to be released to his own sexual and political endeavors.
Mm-hmm. So as much as I dislike atheism and all its implications, I do admire some of these older traditional dogmatic atheists for their honesty in some ways.
Sorry, I may be mistaken. That could have been Huxley. So don't.
I was going to say, I think that is Huxley because I've never read Russell say that.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I was going to just give that to you.
Yeah. And I was like, as soon as I said, I'm like, wait a minute, Russell, that doesn't sound right. I think it's Huxley.
Okay, yeah, it is Huxley.
There
so,
we go.
Just as a reminder.
Thank you, though, by the way. I appreciate your grace.
You can't prove that God exists, and you can't disprove that God exists. But what we can do is give reasons for believing that God does exist.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, this is a cumulative case, and that's why we're sharing lots of arguments for God's existence, the ontological being one of them. And so let's get into that now. Like I said, it's notoriously difficult, so why don't we just start out right in the muck of it and... Mm-hmm. I'll just read for you how Anselm how he wrote it.
And I'll put it up online, so if you would rather read through it, you can just come to that page.
By the way, Anselm lived in the 11th century.
Wasn't he the Archbishop of Canterbury?
That's correct.
Yeah.
So this is what he said. He said, God cannot be conceived not to exist. God is that than which nothing greater can be conceived. That which can be conceived not to exist is not God.
Have we lost you yet?
Yeah. Now, you might want to rewind and listen to that a couple times. Now, I'm only going to read one paragraph now of him teasing this out. "And it assuredly exists so truly that it cannot be conceived not to exist. For it is possible to conceive of a being which cannot be conceived not to exist, and this is greater than one which can be conceived not to exist. Hence, if that than which nothing greater can be conceived can be conceived not to exist, it is not that than which nothing greater can be conceived." Right now it's feeling a little bit complicated because he's making the case with the negative. But this is an This is an irreconcilable contradiction. There is then so truly a being than which nothing greater can be conceived to exist, that it cannot even be conceived not to exist. And this being, thou art our Lord, our God.
Mm-hmm. Anybody who says that those who lived in the so-called Middle Ages didn't know how to reason or any of that does not know what they're talking about. They have not read Anselm.
Yeah, he's pretty intense. And ultimately, what he's saying is this is the way that I phrase the ontological argument that is a little more palatable. Is ultimately what we're saying is God is that which none greater can be conceived.
Like thought of or visualized in our minds.
Yeah, and now he's going to tease that out in all kinds of ways. That in all ways, God is the greatest conceivable being. And thus, and then he's going to say that now his next move is going to be, it is greater. Just take a moment just to dwell on that. God's the greatest being. He's the greatest conceivable being. And then his next question is simply this. Is it greater to exist or not to exist? And so Anselm there is making the argument that it's greater to exist than not to exist. Mm-hmm. Therefore, if God is the greatest conceivable being, he necessarily exists.
Boom.
Boom. So his contemporaries already were kind of firing back at him. And one of them was, well, I can conceive of...
greatest conceivable island.
Island. That's exactly it. Island. And I think that's the kind of mistake that we make, because a lot of atheists and agnostics and other skeptics, they make fun of the ontological argument precisely because they don't get it. Because what we're talking about is a necessary being, not a contingent being. So, but then what they'll do is they'll replace...
You want to just tease that out a little bit more?
Right. Mm-hmm. A necessary...
This is very crucial to understand, because a lot of people who critiqued Anselm, this is where they were making their mistake.
Right. So before we get there, then we have to talk about a possible world. And a possible world simply means how things might have been. So we're not talking about some other universe or some kind of a star system or anything like that. By a possible world, when philosophers say a possible world, it means a total world that might have been different from our actual world, the world that we're actually living in right now. So a necessary being is the kind of a being that is in every possible world. In other words, it's impossible for this being not to exist, right? A necessary being. So, for example, Platonists think forms are like that, right? Or mathematicians think numbers are like the numbers. It's impossible for a number not to exist. Because if there is a world, even a possible world, there's at least the number one, because that world is there. That sort of thing. So they think numbers are in every possible world, so they're a necessary being. A contingent being is one that... Or a thing.
Like an island.
Right.
Or a person.
Is one that is in some possible world or not. But it's certainly not in all possible worlds. Right? So it's because if that were the case, then it would be a necessary being. A contingent being is not in all possible worlds. They might not in any possible world.
And one of the other things that's often brought up with this is one of the ways to demonstrate that is that there's not a necessary state or what's the right word for this? Conclusion that you would arrive at, in the sense that, like with an island, you can constantly add to it. So I can add more palm trees, if you will, to it, or I can think of it being bigger, or I can populate it with different things. So I can constantly be changing it or adding to it. There's not this state at which it is, going back to the argument, the greatest conceivable island. Because the island can always be conceived of as being even greater.
William Lane Craig, he was in a debate, and one of his opponents talked about the greatest conceivable pizza. And he, in a bit of exasperation, essentially said, well, pizzas get eaten, right? Like, how could that be the greatest possible, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, right there, again, that's the misunderstanding between a necessary being and a contingent being. Because mm-hmm. a contingent being can be improved on, just like Andy said. And so often a lot of skeptics will swap out the necessary being with some contingent being. So they'll say, for example, say a unicorn.
That one I hear all the time. Yeah.
Because I think it was on the show, The Atheist Experience, once it was discussed there. And so they'll place a unicorn in there and they follow the ontological argument and therefore a unicorn exists. And then they laugh about it, right? You know, there we go. Yeah. You know, just because we said it existed, well, now it exists apparently, right? But again, they took a misstep there because they swapped out the necessary being with a contingent being.
Mm. And one of the things that I think is interesting about this argument is in Christianity, this is actually a really helpful way of just thinking about what do we mean when we talk about God?
Mm. Mm-hmm.
That when I talk about God, I'm talking about the greatest conceivable being. This is important, too, in our day and age where atheists want to dismiss God as being something that is wholly unintelligible.
Yeah.
I don't even know what it means to be an atheist because I don't know what I'm, you know, not believing in. And you'll hear Dawkins talk about the mm-hmm. flying spaghetti monster or whatever it might be. You know, Christians have a clear definition and idea of what they're talking about. We're talking about the greatest conceivable being. This is what we mean by God.
He's all powerful, like the most powerful, mm-hmm. the most good,
morally perfect,
most loving, mm-hmm. most just.
Yeah, these are omnis, right, mm-hmm. in Christianity. Right. Omnipotent, omnipresent, and omniscient. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I think is interesting, just to leave with you listeners as we come to a conclusion on this, just to dwell on, is I think you can make the argument that the Trinity necessarily, or I would say necessarily follows from the ontological argument, or can follow from the ontological argument, that the greatest conceivable being, when we're talking about God, that it is a greater being, a Trinitarian God is a greater conceivable being than a non-Trinitarian God. Mm-hmm. Now, actually, I think you wrote a little, did you write on
no,
this?
No, a volunteer, Andries, he wrote on Richard Swinburne's argument. Most of the time what happens is to argue for Christian theism, you would make a case for generic theism and then use your arguments for the resurrection of Jesus. But Richard Swinburne is a little unique in that he just goes right to Christian theism without going through the resurrection route. Mm-hmm. So he argues for a Trinity.
I think it's something I've been thinking about for mm-hmm. a good 2 years now, and I think it's absolutely valid
right.
to do. And in fact, because it's interesting, when you read Plato, He dabbles in a lot of Christian ideas that he mm-hmm. arrives at naturally.
He was knocking on the door.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
Natural revelation flowed. Mm-hmm. You know, to put it in Star Wars-esque, natural revelation was strong in this one.
Yeah.
Right? But I think the Trinity is the same thing. Now, we don't have time to get into it, so maybe this can be a teaser for next time, that we could maybe give some arguments for why I think that a Trinitarian God is a greater conceivable being than a non-Trinitarian God.
Maybe we'll cover that as we go over the Thinking Series online course stuff, because starting next week we'll be following the course.
So maybe right? that's what we'll jump into, but just to whet your appetite, those of you that this has got you thinking, we'll post the link to the blog articles that are on our website on Swinburne's ideas.
Yeah, sounds good. Well, thank you, listeners, for joining us today.
Thank you.
The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll see you next week. Ciao for now.